From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our La Crosse studios. Thank you very much for joining me today for an interesting show. Later on in the show, we are getting out in the park outside in the great outdoors with the Great River Shakespeare Festival. That's going to be an interesting experience. It's usually in a theater because the planning happened during COVID precautions. They're moving outdoors this year, and we're going to talk all about that. We'll hear all about the shows that they're doing and how you can get involved in terms of making sure you don't miss those performances. But first, we're talking about the La Crosse schools and a plan to evaluate the facility needs at those schools. Educating our children is, of course, one of the most important things that we do as a society. And yet, what happens when some of those facilities, especially in this city, are approaching 80 years old or even more? Joining us to talk about just that is Dr. Aaron Engel, who is the La Crosse School Superintendent. Dr. Engel, thanks again for joining us on Newsmakers.
Thank you for having me.
So you're evaluating the state of the school's infrastructure, basically. Some of it is really, really old. Some of it is really new. A lot of it is in some state in between. Talk about why that is such an important undertaking this year.
Yeah, so we've been examining our facilities over the last year. Our last long-range facility plan culminated with the building of Northside Elementary School in about 2008. And so since then, we've been, you know, moving forward with smaller plans, 3 to 5 years up until this point. But at this point, we want to establish a long-range facility plan that will take us out 15 or 20 years into the future. And the reason for developing this long-range facility plan is we've got some aging buildings and we've got some declining enrollment. Over the last 20 years, we've lost 1,404 students from our school district. So our schools are less populated than they used to be. Additionally, we've got six buildings that are built before 1940, so over 80 years old, and they've got a lot of maintenance that they need to do just to stay the exact same as they are. And so we're looking at ways to reduce our maintenance liabilities and also to right size our school district for the number of students we have today.
Is it known what's leading to the decline in enrollment? Is it people moving out of town or people choosing a private or parochial schools instead of public schools?
There's a variety of factors that go into declining enrollment in any school district, and they're often unique to schools, school districts. But generally speaking, you know, the nation as a whole, our state as a whole, has been facing declining birth rates for many, many years. And La Crosse is no different than other areas of the state or the nation. So this is part of longer, bigger trends than just La Crosse. And that's the primary driver based on our analysis. And so families are smaller than they used to be. I have three siblings and most families today have one to two children, you know, so things are just different than they used to be 20, 30, 40 years ago. And that leads to fewer schools in our school district. The family is half the size that it used to be 40 years ago. We could expect half the number of students in our schools with the same number of families in our community.
So six of the facilities, you mentioned six of those facilities approaching 80 years old or more. Are those schools or administrative buildings or what goes on in those facilities?
Yeah, five of those are schools. We've got two elementaries and three middle schools that are in that age range. And then also our administrative center, Hogan, is also old. It was built in 1921.
And Hogan doesn't have a school in it anymore, right? It had one of the charter schools was in Hogan and it moved elsewhere.
Yeah, that's correct. In the 19 early 80s, maybe late 70s, Hogan Elementary was converted into an administrative building, part of a response to declining enrollment at that time. And for a period of time, the Seven Rivers High School was located at the Hogan Administrative Center, was recently moved to the La Crosse Polytechnic Building downtown.
When you look at these older facilities, the people in the neighborhoods or people concerned with historic preservation, those kinds of things, look at these old buildings and with such an emphasis on protecting the old architecture and the structures that have been part of our communities for so long. How do you balance the needs of a community not to just let its history go versus the needs of a school district to have adequate modern facilities for students?
I personally love old architecture. My mother was an art teacher. And so in the summers and on trips, we were always looking at, you know, art museums and going on architectural tours. And, you know, I love the architecture of our older buildings in our school district. When I walk through Lincoln Middle School, you know, I feel like I'm in a Harry Potter movie. It's got that kind of, there's just a nostalgia there, and things were built differently, you know, in the 20s and 30s. And so I am very appreciative of the history of the architecture in our community. At the same time, you know, our obligation is to provide the best possible education for our students. And over the years, our expectations have changed in our society, in our community, for what a building provides in order to provide that best education. I recently wrote an article in the paper that talked about Emerson Elementary and just its evolution over the years. And the core of that building is a historic building that's, you know, aged gracefully and has a lot of nice brick features. But the internal workings of it have deteriorated. The plumbing is old. The HVAC had to be replaced recently. You know, there's windows and doors that need to be replaced. It's not handicapped accessible the way it ought to be for modern standards. And it has evolved over the years. When it was originally constructed, it did not have a cafeteria. It did not have a gymnasium. It did not have a library media center. It didn't have an art room or a music room, because education in 1930 was vastly different than it is today. Over time, state standards changed, our community's expectations changed, and we had to add on each of those features along the way in order to meet the modern needs of our students. And 80 or 100 years later, we're getting to a point where adding on or, you know, modifying what we have may not be sufficient any longer to meet the modern needs of our students.
You raised the issue of accessibility as it relates to Emerson. How often is accessibility an issue in some of these older buildings?
We certainly meet the needs of our students as best we can, and we are absolutely 100% compliant with the standards that we're required to be. But there are situations where, you know, it just doesn't, you know, make us feel good to meet those standards, but not provide the best possible situation for our students. I won't use Emerson as an example, but Lincoln Middle School, we don't have fully accessible bathrooms on our second and third floors. And so students that are in a wheelchair often have to go to the first floor to access bathrooms where their peers do not have to. And that leads to equity issues, that leads to, you know, equality issues. And that's not a situation where we want. We want every child to have the same experience as their peers, regardless of their ability. And so that's an example where we're not able to provide what we want to because of the historical construction and the building standards of the 1930s. We meet state statutes, we meet all the regulations, we're providing, you know, the minimum necessary for our students, but we're not providing the best possible educational experience for kids, and that's not where we want to be.
In terms of access isn't the only aspect of equity and inclusion. How are those issues impacted by these older facilities in terms of not necessarily access, but other maybe social understandings that we have now that are different, or expectations of privacy that are different than they used to be, 60, 70 years ago when these facilities were built?
Yeah, we've come a long way in terms of maintenance to upgrade our facilities. You know, locker rooms, you know, there's been changing expectations about those spaces and what we believe is acceptable. We want more privacy, you know, for students, particularly in middle school, you know, who are going through a lot of changes. We find that kids are more likely to engage and participate and feel like they belong when they have access to private places to change. You know, our older facilities have difficulty being modified to meet those expectations. We do the best we possibly can, and we've done that wherever we can. But, you know, those are some things. Another changing expectation is our schools used to be, you know, a place where a kid would go for their education. They would come home for lunch and go back to school for the rest of the day. And that was really all they used that building. Our school buildings today have become more like community centers. They've really become the hub of our neighborhoods and our communities in general. And they're used a lot more by outside entities, by community groups, athletics. We have partnerships with the YMCA, the Boys and Girls Club. Our schools are used more than ever by our communities. The buildings that we've built recently or modified and added on to, like Northside Elementary and Hamilton Elementary, have really become community hubs based on the modern architecture that we've been able to put in place there. They serve, you know, before and after school programs more effectively. Our community is able to use those public spaces more effectively. And our older buildings just don't have quite the same capacity that those modern facilities do. And if we're able to build new elementaries or new middle schools or new high schools, those buildings will serve our community far better than our existing structures can.
When you're looking at a facility, you talked about the Northside project that was such an undertaking, and yet it's been over 10 years since that project was completed. When you design a school building, how long do you expect that to last? Both of the high schools, one of my parents graduated from each of the high schools that are still in use, and that was, you know, back in the 70s. And so, you know, those schools that were new when my parents were in them are aging and might be considered in need of upgrades. So how do you determine how long a school building is supposed to exist?
Historically, the designed life cycle of a building was about 80 years. So that is a benchmark that we can look to. That said, though, there's lots of variability in construction methods over the years. You know, if we look at our three middle schools as an example, we've got Logan Middle School on the north side. We've got Lincoln Middle School kind of centered in the middle of the city. And then we've got Longfellow Middle School a little bit further south than Lincoln. The best built building is Longfellow Middle School, even though all three were built at about the same year. The difference being Longfellow was literally built to be a bomb shelter. You know, it's got it's got 2 foot thick concrete walls as its base. At one point, a number of years ago, a tornado passed over the school and it wasn't touched at all. Nothing moved. You know, it's just a really, really well built building that has stood the test of time in a way that some of our other buildings have not. A number of years ago, the copper pipe that was purchased across the country was just of subpar quality for some reason. The copper that was mined and smelted at the time didn't hold up. And within 10 years, all those buildings had to replace their copper pipe. You know, so it kind of depends on what goes on at the time, the building construction methods used. Another example, Emerson Elementary is a really well-built building. It's held up for, you know, over 80 years. We can look at Spence Elementary, which just wasn't constructed as well as buildings in the 30s, even though it was built, you know, in the 50s. More modern construction, but not as high quality as some previous construction. And so there's a lot of variables that go into how long a building can last. But, you know, as we do annual assessments, as we do longer range assessments, we're kind of looking at what are the maintenance needs as we move forward and looking at that cost effectiveness of investing in what we have versus seeking to build something new that will last for the next 80 or 100 years.
We're talking to Dr. Aaron Engel, who's the superintendent of La Crosse Schools. We're talking about his district's undertaking a project where facilities are being reevaluated. Input from the public will be received. We'll talk about that in just a moment. And it's all in an effort to establish a long-range plan for the facilities within the La Crosse School District. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. You can get in touch with the show by emailing us. It's newsmakers@wisconsinpublicradio.org. I'm Ezra Wall. We'll be back in just a minute on Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall, joined by Dr. Aaron Engel from the La Crosse Schools. And we're talking about an evaluation of the school's facilities. And here's an interesting thing. The public is going to be an integral part of this. The school district has a number of opportunities for public input. Dr. Engel, the first of those is coming right up next week or so. But there's one on the north side, one on the south side. Talk about those, at least the two meetings that are upcoming.
Yeah, we're looking for public input. We've already held two focus groups with community members that we reached out to, but we want anyone who has an interest to be able to stop by and participate. And so on June 30th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at Logan Middle School, we'll be holding our first focus group. And then the second one will be on July 7th from 6 to 8 p.m. At Longfellow Middle School. And if folks are interested in attending, we ask that they RSVP if they can by reaching out to our district office and contacting Kelly Galvan here just to get their name on the list.
And I know people are going to have a hard time remembering phone numbers and such over the radio, but in case somebody does have a good memory wants that specific information to refer back to later, how do they get in touch with the district office?
Yeah, they could either email Kelly Galvan at lacrossesd.org, kgalvan, or they can give us a phone call and we'll put them on the list as well. And our number here is 608-789-7628.
And the focus groups are going to be at Logan Middle and Longfellow Middle. If the date is not convenient, like is that designed so that people within the Logan district would go to that one, or if that date isn't convenient, could somebody from that part of town go to the Longfellow meeting and vice versa?
Yep, anybody could go attend either meeting. We just wanted to try and geographically make it a little more accessible to folks on the north side of town and the south side of town in case walking or biking was a preferred mode of transportation.
And these are focus groups as opposed to like a town hall style thing or like a city council meeting, sign up and speak at it or something like that. What are people going to experience when they come to one of these sessions?
Yeah, our goal is to provide some background information, to provide some historical context and current context, and then provide a range of options that we're examining. And our goal is really community feedback. We know that any plan that we develop, if it involves building new things or going to referendum for capital maintenance or capital projects, we need the public support. And so really understanding the public's views on our process and what they want for educational buildings in the future is crucial. So we'll start with some historical context, talking about enrollment, our facility study and maintenance, and getting feedback along the way. And then we'll dive into the range of options that we've considered and are thinking about and seek community input on those to understand what they think is viable or best serves their needs as a community and for their children.
When a lot of people in the public look at some proposals that might involve replacing versus retrofitting existing facilities, especially some of the oldest facilities, how do you go? What's the cost difference in like raise a building, start from scratch with a brand new facility there versus take a building and not just make it good enough, but really truly retrofit it to meet current modern needs?
Yeah, there's a cost benefit waiting there, a process of kind of examining, you know, what the cost would be to retrofit versus build new. In some cases, you know, there's just no way to get to a modern educational environment with our historical buildings without, you know, astronomical costs that would exceed even building new. You know, generally speaking, it's more cost efficient to renovate what you have than it is to build new. But if we're looking at significantly rearranging spaces, or if the spaces simply aren't conducive to being large enough or arranged in the right way, it might not even be possible to keep what we have right now in order to achieve that modern educational environment that we need. And we've got a really good estimate of maintenance costs for our buildings. You know, for an elementary, it might be $3 to $3.5 million, you know, to fix them, to address the existing maintenance needs. But that $3-3.5 million won't address a modern educational environment. It'll just fix the roofs, the plumbing, the doors. We'll get exactly what we had, but good for the next 10, 20 years. If we want to really make a difference and adapt to 21st century learning to the next 80 years of needs of our students, it would cost far, far more.
I saw a report about the Solar on La Crosse Schools project just this week, and that was interesting to see. That we had them on the show last year before the very first installation that they did. And it's interesting to see that effort and the way that they're involving students in that education. But in a process like this, it makes me think of how much of the consideration for how to build new facilities is environmental, and what opportunities are there if you're starting with a new facility to create more energy efficient, more earth friendly buildings and schools.
Yeah, that's absolutely a consideration of ours. We were fortunate to have an incredibly generous anonymous donor for the Hamilton project who wanted to help us put solar on that building. And as a result, our energy costs are next to nothing for that addition for the length of that solar panel's life. So we're incredibly thankful for that donor and really excited for that educational opportunity for students and to be part of a green project that, you know, helps our environment and helps address, you know, global climate change. Northside is another example where we used more environmentally friendly HVAC processes. We've got geothermal there, you know, so we've got, I think it's like 30 wells dug that help heat and cool the building in a more environmentally friendly way. And any new building that we do will be absolutely seeking out modern methods of energy consumption and generation in order to lower our operational costs and do right by our planet.
When you look at the facilities that you're considering either replacing completely or that are in need of the most upgrades, how are these facilities located? Are they sort of proportionally in dispersed among different kinds of socioeconomic areas, or do you see a lot of them in the lower income parts of town, or a lot of them in the higher income parts of town, or where are these buildings across the district?
It's relatively balanced. The three middle schools are buildings that we're looking at. They were built in the 1930s. So Lincoln Middle, Logan Middle, and Longfellow Middle. And then the two elementaries that we're looking at are Emerson Elementary and Spence Elementary. And they've got, average to, you know, rates of poverty relative to our school district in those elementary buildings. You know, our attendance zones have been changed over the years, and we're trying to create diverse socioeconomic student populations, because we've historically seen some evidence that that's what's best for kids. And so, you know, those would be the five educational buildings that we'd be looking at. And, three of four of them really are located on the south side of the La Crosse River, kind of in the more the heart of the city.
When you're building a facility to educate our sort of modern students, I guess I can understand you talked about like locker room facilities. I'm assuming lab facilities might come into play in terms of high school students and whatnot, and some of the other kinds of facilities you need. The technology is easier to build into buildings that are designed to accept our modern technology. Aside from those kinds of things, are there differences in teaching students in a building that just feels old versus a building that feels sort of new? Or does it have an impact on their ability to learn?
There's some research that shows that when students feel pride in their building, when they feel excited to come to school, when they feel like they're valued in their physical structures, that there is a difference in outcomes for students. The most important factor is always teachers and the community that they build and the environment that they build. But there is some evidence to show that if you're coming to a building that you feel pride in, and it could be an old building that's well taken care of, but if it's a new building, there's often, an increase in attendance and an increase in test scores because kids feel pride. They feel like they're valued. They feel a sense of belonging to this new thing. So there is some evidence that some new structures can have that impact, but it's really about a kid's sense of belonging, a sense of pride. And that could be in an older building, but newer buildings certainly have that effect as well. More importantly, I think about the different ways that we expect students to learn, our different teaching methods that we use today. The fundamentals are probably the same as they were in the 1930s, but we do things vastly different. We've learned a lot about how kids learn. We've learned a lot about how we can best teach. And so collaborative spaces are important now. Small group spaces are important now. Access to science, technology, engineering, math spaces are more important than they've ever been. And we also think about different types of career and technical education that we didn't have when we built these buildings, whether that's family consumer science, technical education, even things like music, art, and FIAD. Those spaces are vastly different now if you build new than they were historically. And we really want to accommodate that 21st century learning, the best teaching practices of today. And it's really hard to retrofit our historical buildings to meet those modern needs.
When you talk about building new buildings especially, but really major upgrades to even existing buildings, you're of course talking about additional funding. In this school district and in the state of Wisconsin, where does that funding come from? Is that going to require a legislative appropriation of some kind? Is that going to require like a local ballot initiative of any kind?
Generally speaking, in Wisconsin, if you want to build new stuff or do significant capital maintenance, you have to go to referendum. So it'd be a ballot item that the public would vote on. We have some fund balance that we mostly use, for cash flow purposes throughout the school year and in case there's contingencies that come up. But, and that can get us a little ways on maintenance. But if we want to do something big, we definitely have to go to the taxpayers and we have to ask them. And that's why it's so crucial to get community input. We want to develop a plan that our community can support, that our community is excited about, so that if and when we go to referendum, they're excited about that possibility and can support it at a high rate. We've had a long history of success of passing operational and capital referendums in the school district. And so we feel that, if we're meeting our community's needs, there'll be a strong support for public education in any referendum we put on the ballot.
Dr. Aaron Engel is the superintendent of La Crosse Schools. Dr. Engel, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this conversation again or any of our previous episodes, you can find them online. That's wpr.org/newsmakers. Our program continues in just a moment. We're talking Shakespeare next, right here on Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall in our studios on the campus of the University of Wisconsin La Crosse. Heading up to Winona now to talk some Shakespeare. The Great River Shakespeare Festival is back this summer with some exciting changes, and here to talk about the festival and all the different shows that you can see is Eileen Moeller, who's with the Great River Shakespeare Festival. Eileen, thank you so much for joining us on Newsmakers.
Thanks for having me.
This year, you're taking it outdoors, Shakespeare outdoors, Winona style. Talk about that.
Yes. So it's a big change this year. As with many theater productions, it's a massive undertaking with a lot of decisions involved. And so we had to make some decisions about how to produce our season back in February when there were still so many unknowns. We didn't know who would be vaccinated or if there would be vaccines and what rules would be in place. And so we started planning for an outdoor season. Fortunately, we've been able to work with the city of Winona and use Levee Park, which is right on the river. And then we are also continuing our relationship with Winona State University and performing one production on the campus of Winona State outdoors. So we have two locations, two plays will be performed at the Levee stage and one play will be performed at Winona State. And then we'll have some other events happening as well. But yes, we are moving outdoors, so it looks a lot different this year. Typically, there is a lot of production value with lighting and sound and costumes. And we still have, you know, our costume designers. We still have sound design. We don't have lighting design this year because we just have sunlight, which is new and different. But it's still going to be beautiful, professionally done, really compelling theater.
You talked about two plays being at one location, one play being at another one. We'll get to the other events later, but the three main productions are The Tempest, Great Expectations, and Every Brilliant Thing. Well, I don't know what order you want to take those in, but let's just go with The Tempest first, because it's, I think, one everybody's at least a bit familiar with. Talk about The Tempest.
Yeah, so we typically do two professional Shakespeare productions in a year. We had scheduled this year The Tempest and The Taming of the Shrew. And because The Taming of the Shrew is a romance and requires a lot of close contact among actors and kissing and things like that, we decided to just hold off on it until next summer when we can fully produce the director's vision. So The Tempest is our one big Shakespeare production this year. It's actually perfect for an outdoor setting because it's about Prospero, who is a sort of sorcerer, magician type person who is exiled to an island with his daughter, Miranda. And they are, you know, sort of living just on their own resources. They've been stranded there for Miranda's entire life. And then Prospero has managed to sort of capture a spirit from the island who helps Prospero out. And then, of course, these nobles get shipwrecked on the island, and inevitably Miranda falls in love with one of them. So it's a very, it's very ideal for being performed outdoors, and especially so close to the river, to the water. And it's a really stellar performance by all of the actors involved. It's got some of the best lines from Shakespeare in it. It's one of my favorites. So it's really a spectacular thing to see outdoors.
One of the other programs that you're doing is Great Expectations. And I think everyone knows that's not Shakespeare. Talk about Great Expectations.
Yeah, so many people may have read Great Expectations in high school English. It's a Charles Dickens novel that was originally published as a serial. He published a chapter every week. And we are doing a production that is an adaptation of the novel written by a playwright named Gail Childs Daly. She's actually from Wisconsin, or lives in Wisconsin. And she's been at the festival before. She has directed, and her husband, John Daly, has been a company member in the past. So we have a great relationship with her. And this is a really lovely production, a lovely play that she's written. And it's a great story. It's a perfect family show. You know, we follow Pip as he's a young boy and orphaned, and he gets into all of these different situations. The character Miss Havisham, who's very well known as one of Dickens' characters, is in this play. And it's a great piece of theater to watch because you have a small group of actors who are playing multiple roles. And so you really get to see the flexibility and the nimbleness of those actors who are taking on different accents and completely changing their character with just a few costume changes. And so it's a great story. It's something that will feel familiar to many people, but with a totally new twist on it. So that's a great family show for anyone who wants to bring their kids to the theater, but maybe isn't sure about Shakespeare.
When you're looking at an adaptation like that, it's always interesting to see, especially when it's adapted from such a well-known work, how much is the playwright and how much of Dickens is left?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm not a dramaturg or a text coach, so I don't have quite the history that some of our other staff know about that. But I do know from watching the play and listening to it that you get the feel of a Dickens novel. So that sort of, I don't know if you'd call it a Victorian Gothic kind of feel to it, but it seems to really capture the atmosphere of a Dickens novel, which is dark but kind of funny, and there's always some misadventure. There's a lot of really wry humor, and Gail does a really great job keeping that part of it in the play. It definitely adds her own touch to it.
It sounds very interesting. Now, the other of the three main productions that you're doing is called Every Brilliant Thing. I enjoy the theater. I wouldn't call myself a connoisseur. I'm certainly not well educated in it, and I was not familiar with Every Brilliant Thing. Tell me about it.
Yes, so that is a contemporary play. Was written in the last probably 5 or 6 years by playwrights Johnny Donahoe and Duncan McMillan, excuse me. And it's become very popular. I think it was actually picked up to be an HBO special, but it is a short one-person production. And it is about the main character, the narrator, their experience with their mother's mental health struggles and her attempts at suicide. And so it has this overarching theme of what mental health struggles do to a family and how a young child perceives them. And then as the narrator gets older, how they struggle with mental health themselves. But there are moments in it that are really sad and poignant, but overall it's a very funny, very heartwarming play. It's beautiful. And one of the coolest things about it is that it's interactive with the audience in a way that doesn't feel uncomfortable. It feels totally natural. The way the play is written to include the audience doesn't make any one audience member feel put on the spot or awkward or anything. And the fact that one is outdoors as well, normally it's performed in a black box theater, someplace really intimate. And so the director, Andrew Carlson, and the actor, Michael Fitzpatrick, have done a really wonderful job of replicating that intimate feeling in a very large outdoor space where we have rules about how close Michael can get to the audience because of our actors union. They can't touch audience members. They can't be closer than 10 feet to audience members. So it was difficult for them to stage the play with all of those rules in mind. But what they have done is really fabulous, and it's a really beautiful thing. And it's, like I said, it's a one act. So it runs at just about an hour. So it's a really great way to experience a different kind of theatrical experience.
How many actors are you working with this summer?
We have, I believe, we have 13, in our professional acting company. In a typical year, we usually have 16, but because we don't have two Shakespeare plays, our cast is a little bit smaller this year.
And so do each of those actors have roles in each of the, well, you said one was a one-person play, but do the other actors have roles in both of the plays that they're doing?
Yes. So we are what's called a repertory company, which means that we're performing several different plays simultaneously throughout the summer. So we have a stable of actors, and for the most part, those actors appear in more than one production. Sometimes when we have three plays, there are people who are in all three. Usually some of the smaller or rather less prominent roles, folks will play more than one role in one play. And then folks who have like a bigger load of character load basically will sometimes be in just one play. But yes, I think at least 6 to 10 of the actors are in two plays.
Those are the professional actors, and there are student actors that are part of your program as well. Talk about the internship program.
Yeah, so one very important part of our company is education. We have an intern program and an apprentice program. So the intern program is for technical internships. So people who are usually early in their career or still in college are coming to us for the summer and they are learning a trade. They are working in the scene shop or the costume shop, or at times they've worked in administration with me. And then our apprenticeship program, those are all understudies for the actors. And then they also take classes on things like scansion and text work and auditioning and all these kinds of things. And then in a typical year, towards the end of the summer, the apprentices and interns work together to mount their own production. This year, we're doing that a little bit differently. The apprentices are still performing their own production, but instead of it running for a week as it normally does, they have split it into 20-minute episodes. So if you arrive a half hour early before any of the Levy performances, so a half hour before Great Expectations or a half hour before The Tempest, you will get to see a 20-minute episode of Romeo and Juliet performed by our apprentice company. And then if you want to see the whole play, they're performing it for one night only on July 31st on the Levy stage. So they're definitely learning their own skills. They're doing their own production in addition to understudying all of the professional acting company members. So they are very busy.
It sounds like an amazing opportunity for them.
It is. And we often will have people go through our apprentice program, and then in years later, we will hire them back as part of the professional acting company. So they're definitely learning a lot of skills that guide them as they enter the world of being a professional performer.
I was looking at your calendar online and the schedule of performances, and starting the last week of June and going all the way through July and ending literally on August 1st, there are performances virtually every day that people can attend. And for those who live in Winona, it might not require much planning in terms of picking a show to go to at any given time. For those who might have to travel into Winona, what's a good strategy in terms of trying to catch everything if they want to, or trying to catch, get the biggest bang for their travel time?
We have performances Tuesdays through Sundays. In a typical year, we would have a couple matinee performances throughout the week. Again, everything is different this year, so we have made some changes to our schedule. We have only a few matinee performances. However, if someone is able to be in town for three nights, then you would be able to see all three plays if you wanted to. So you could come on a Thursday and see one show, see another show Friday, and then see a third show Saturday. Or same thing if you came into town on Friday. So we schedule it so that the same shows are running pretty much every other day. And The Tempest and Every Brilliant Thing typically run opposite each other. So they're playing at the same time at different venues. So one night you would see The Tempest, next night you could see Great Expectations, and then the third night you could see Every Brilliant Thing. So there's a lot of opportunities to see all three of the productions.
And there are, if you just want to pick two, they're on Saturdays, right? You do two productions on Saturdays.
Yes,
you do all the productions on Saturdays, but there you could attend two productions on Saturdays.
Correct. Yes. Most Saturdays we will have a matinee, which this year our matinees begin at 11:30 a.m. And then we would have an evening performance at 6:30 p.m. And the reason we moved all the performance times up this year is because, as I mentioned earlier, we are using sunlight. So we need to end the performances before the sun is completely gone.
Yeah, that's got to be a challenge. I mean, you get to the last act of Shakespeare and you're kind of peering through shadows to see what's going on if it's too late in the evening.
I have to say, as a front of house professional who has been encouraging our directors to shorten the plays because patrons do tend to get a bit exhausted after 2.5 hours of theater, we have kept all of the productions to less than 2 hours this year, and I'm very excited about it. So if you come to a 6:30 show, we'll have a 20-minute intermission, and the play should be done by 9 o'clock. And there's still enough light to get home by. So it's a wonderful evening. And last night we had a preview of The Tempest, and it finished right as the sun was going down. The sky was all pink. It was absolutely beautiful. So really a special experience.
That really sounds amazing. So what else is going on at the festival that I might be missing? We've pretty much talked about the three main staged productions.
Yes. So we have two other regular events that happen during the week that will start the week after July 4th. We will have company conversations on Sundays, and those are an opportunity to have face-to-face time with some of the actors, sometimes the designers, educators, and it's a guided discussion about a particular topic. It changes from week to week. We're doing those on Zoom this year, so everyone is invited. It's free. And the good thing is, if you, for example, were to come into town for the weekend, but you need to leave before that conversation happens, you can join from anywhere. So that's a really nice accessibility piece this year. And then the other events we have are called Front Porch events, and those are more like a keynote speaker type situation where someone comes in to speak on a particular topic. Usually there's a question and answer portion. We also have a workshop as part of that this year by an actress named Judy Tate, who is a very well-known film and television actress, as well as a director and I think playwright too. So some of those events are ticketed. They're never more than $10. And then a couple of those are free. And those will also be on Zoom, so folks have the opportunity to engage with the festival no matter where they are.
And speaking of tickets and all of that, where can people find information about the Great River Shakespeare Festival?
The best place is our website, grsf.org. So GreatRiverShakespeareFestival.org. And there's a button at the top that says buy tickets. And if you click on that, it will list all the events as well as descriptions. And then you can choose a day you want to come. I would like to mention that because of our outdoor seating this year, instead of selling individual seats like we would in a theater, we are selling pods, and a pod fits two people. So whether you're coming yourself or whether you are coming with another person, you purchase one pod, it's the same price. And we have to do that just because of the social distancing requirements that were set up when we planned everything, and the rules from the Actors Union. So that's how we're doing it this year. So if you were to attend with a friend or a partner or whatever, you'd only have to purchase one pod and you would get that one ticket, and that would let you both in. So It's been a little bit tricky this year because it's different and it's new. Hopefully next year we'll be selling seats again. But the nice thing this year is that you can bring a picnic. If you're at the levee, you can actually bring a drink with you, as long as it's not in a glass bottle. And it's a nice casual atmosphere. So a lot of fun out there on the river.
Eileen Moeller is with the Great River Shakespeare Festival. Eileen, thanks for joining us on Newsmakers.
Thanks for having me.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I appreciate your listening today. Our program is produced by Dawn Jewell with help from John Davis and the rest of the La Crosse staff. There's a couple opportunities to hear the show every week, Fridays at 10 a.m. on Ideas 90.3 and Fridays at 7 p.m. on NPR News and Music 88.9. Please join us again next time. You can find all of our episodes online if you want to do some listening. Until then, it's wpr.org/newsmakers. And of course, you can always get in touch with the show. Send us your ideas, your comments, your thoughts and concerns. Email them to newsmakers@wpr.org. That's newsmakers@wpr.org. Until next time, I'm Ezra Wall. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio.